Ranked 25th for valor among all U.S. service members, nearly 600 combat missions flown. Today, we're diving deep into some of Colonel James C. Harding's most, well, harrowing experiences in Vietnam.
Absolutely. And specifically focusing on those incredibly dangerous combat search and rescue missions.
And we have the privilege of drawing directly from Colonel Harding's own words, right? From a recent interview.
That's right. It gives us a really raw, firsthand account. It actually ties in quite well with our earlier deep dive on forward air controllers. That was episode 70, if you remember.
I do remember. We talked a lot about the role of FACs, and Colonel Harding fits right into that picture.
He really does. A decorated military hero, command pilot, master parachutist, and crucially, commander of the 1st Special Operations Squadron, the famous Hobos, flying those A-1 Sky Raider missions.
As the Sky Raiders, those propeller-driven workhorses.
Exactly. And this isn't going to be, you know, a dry history lesson. We're going right into the thick of it.
Getting that firsthand account of combat search and rescue, the intensity, the danger.
The sheer danger, yes. And frankly, some moments it sound almost unbelievable, like something out of a movie script.
So our aim here, much like when we looked at air power strategy back in episode 70, is to really get under the skin of this specific aspect of the conflict.
Our mission today, for you listening, is pretty clear. Understand the vital role of those FACs and the extraordinary, almost unimaginable risks they took rescuing downed airmen.
Through Colonel Harding's eyes, essentially. A unique perspective on that whole period.
A unique and visceral perspective. A stick-in-hand view, you could say, which really complements the broader strategic stuff we talked about in episode 70.
Okay, let's unpack this then. How does someone go from growing up on a dairy farm to becoming this highly decorated combat pilot? That seems like quite a leap.
It really does. His first real encounter with aircraft was actually in college, ROTC. He had to join to avoid the draft, as he put it.
And his major wasn't aviation.
Not at all. Animal husbandry. Thinking about cows, not cockpits initially. A world away from the A-1 Sky Raider, that rugged plane known for carrying a massive weapons load and just hanging around over the battlefield.
Animal husbandry to A-1s. So what was the turning point? What sparked the interest in flying?
Well, it seems that first flight during an ROTC summer camp did something. Then when he graduated in 56, the Air Force offered him a regular commission.
And he had other options too, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. A farm machinery company wanted him. And get this, the Los Angeles Rams apparently scouted him as a potential lineman.
The LA Rams. Seriously. Wow.
Seriously. But he chose flying. A pretty pivotal decision, wouldn't you say? Led him straight to the experiences we're talking about today.
Definitely a fork in the road. So, okay, he chooses flying. What was his path then towards becoming ready for Vietnam?
It was that steady pilot training pipeline. Primary at Mariana Air Base, then basic at Laredo. He became an instructor at Moody Air Force Base, flying T-33s.
Jet trainers.
Right. And he even checked out in the F-86 Sabre, the Korean War jet. Plus, he played football at Moody, was a squadron commander at Lackland. So he had leadership chops early on. Similar paths to some of the FACs we looked at in episode 70, actually.
And it wasn't purely training for long, was it? He saw some real-world tension pretty early. Cuba.
That's right. The Cuban Missile Crisis. He flew 4 combat missions over Cuba in F-84s.
F-84 Thunderjets. So propeller planes, again, for those missions?
No, the F-84 was an early jet fighter bomber. And what's interesting is his take on it, he felt they were really close to actual shooting, though maybe not nuclear war right then. He also mentioned training foreign pilots for similar ops, so that global tension was already there.
From the brink in Cuba to strategic planning in Okinawa, that sounds like a completely different skill set.
Totally different. In 63, he's a plans officer in Okinawa, writing defense plans for the Pacific. We're talking big picture strategy against China and Russia.
High security clearance stuff, I imagine.
Very high. Involved in the SCOP, the Single Integrated Operations Plan, the main combat jets there were F-105 Thunder Chiefs, supersonic birds that later saw a lot of action over Vietnam. Yeah. So he had this broad strategic view before diving into the specifics of Southeast Asia.
Okay, so how did he transition from that strategic planning role to being boots on the ground or maybe helmet in the cockpit in Vietnam?
It happened gradually. His first trip over in 64 from Okinawa was actually as a ground FAC. He was embedded with the 173rd Airborne Brigade.
The first major U.S. unit there?
Exactly. And he was also involved in training South Vietnamese pilots, flying AT-37s and AT-28s prop attack planes. That ground experience was vital later for his airborne FAC work, something we stressed in episode 70, that understanding of the ground perspective.
Being a FAC on the ground in the jungle, he talked about the limited visibility must have been incredibly difficult to direct airstrikes effectively.
Hugely frustrating. He actually flew with a guy named Tom Dwelly in an A1 just to get that aerial view. It showed him the limitations of being stuck on the ground.
So that pushed him towards flying FAC missions himself.
Pretty much. He started flying the L-19, which the Air Force later called the O-1 Bird Dog. And this was before they even had proper Air Force manuals for it.
Flying a combat mission without the official instruction book? That takes some nerve.
He was definitely learning on the fly, literally. He told a funny story about a Vietnamese observer on one flight and also remembered the first time he took enemy fire. He was the air liaison officer for the brigade commander, that critical link between the troops and the air support.
He mentioned the 173rd was pretty green compared to the Australians who were also there early on. It sounds like effective FAC support was absolutely essential from the get-go.
It really was. They were up against experienced Viet Cong backed by North Vietnam. The country was divided, the conflict escalating. It was complex. And sometimes troops were just too far out for their own artillery.
Making air support the only option.
The only option. Which highlights just how vital those FACs were in extending the Army's reach. A key theme from our episode 70 discussion.
And he didn't just fly these improvised missions. He actually helped shape how the Air Force did it.
Yes, he realized the procedures were all based on Army terms. So we went back to Cessna, the manufacturer, and wrote the MAC-1 manual for the O-1, translating it all into Air Force speak.
Bringing it into their system.
Right. And he got an early look at the Cessna 337A, the plane that became the O-2 Skymaster, that twin-boom pusher-puller design. He saw right away it would be a much better FAC aircraft, better visibility, could stay airborne longer. A definite step up, like the aircraft advancements we touched on in episode 70.
He mentioned flying back and forth from Okinawa on temporary duty, TDY assignments. It paints a picture of constant demand for expertise on the ground as things ramped up.
Definitely. He described the conditions starting out living in tents outside Bien Hoa Air Base, then slowly getting wooden floors, then concrete. But his role as a standardization and evaluation instructor was really key.
Spreading the knowledge.
Exactly. Traveling between units, seeing what worked best, collecting those best practices, and then standardizing the FAC procedures across the board. Vital for making sure everyone was on the same page.
And his work wasn't just with U.S. or South Vietnamese troops, right? He worked with other allies, too.
Yeah, he had a stint with the Republic of Korea Capital Division. Said working through an interpreter was a real challenge. He even went back to Korea later to brief their F-86 pilots on FAC procedures for the DMZ.
Wow, that's quite varied experience.
And he supported the U.S. 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One, on their search and destroy operations. That included flying recon after B-52 strikes and supported the guys going into the tunnels, the Tunnel Rats. Shows the broad range of operations FAC supported.
The Tunnel Rats.
Yeah.
Incredible bravery. Then he shifted again to night operations over Laos, hitting the Ho Chi Minh Trail. That sounds like next level danger.
It's extremely high risk. Flying propeller-driven AT-28s out of Nakhon Phanom in Thailand over supposedly neutral Laos. They were using early night vision starlight scopes and flares to find trucks moving supplies down the trail at night.
And the crews weren't all American.
No. He mentioned South Vietnamese, Laotian, and Thai pilots were involved. It was this whole secret war, trying to cut off the supplies flowing south while the North Vietnamese were working constantly to repair the damage.
He also mentioned the more high-tech side of monitoring the trail, right? Sensors and things.
Yeah, Task Force Alpha. Dropping acoustic and seismic sensors along the trail to listen for trucks and troop movements. They'd fly Ku-22 aircraft to relay the data.
Like electronic tripwires?
Kind of. Colonel Harding noted how much faster they could get intel that way compared to traditional methods. It shows the technological side of the war, constantly evolving, just like the FAC aircraft we discussed back in episode 70.
Then comes 1971. He returns to Vietnam, but this time flying A-1 Sky Raiders. The whole nature of the war was shifting then, wasn't it?
Oh, big time. U.S. ground troops were pulling out, so the focus really shifted heavily towards stopping supplies coming down from North Vietnam and, crucially, rescuing downed aircrew.
And the A-1 Sky Raider. What was his take on that aircraft? It's pretty iconic.
It is. Big propeller plane, a tail dragger. He said initially it felt a bit clumsy compared to the jets he'd flown, but he quickly appreciated its maneuverability down low and its toughness. It could take a lot of hits and keep flying, which was essential for what lay ahead.
He even used it to direct naval gunfire, calling in shots from battleships.
Yeah, imagine that. directing 16-inch naval guns from an A-1 overhead. He said when directed properly, they were incredibly accurate. It shows that joint operations aspect. And his leadership role ramped up too. He became operations officer for the 1st Special Hop Squadron, the Hobos, under Wing Commander Jack Robinson, destined to eventually take command.
So he was scheduling missions, training pilots, making sure the planes were ready, right in the thick of planning these high-stakes ops.
Exactly. And with fewer U.S. ground troops, search and rescue became even more critical. Every lost pilot or crew member was a huge blow, strategically and morally.
The pressure must have been immense.
Absolutely. Supporting ground units ambushed, pulling out downed airmen, that became a primary focus. Strike missions still happened, of course, north and on the trail, but there were also bombing halts that let the North Vietnamese rebuild and resupply, which just increased the danger and the need for rescue.
Which brings us to the really intense part of his story, those incredibly harrowing rescue missions and his own experiences getting shot down. He mentioned heavy hook missions first.
Right. These were top secret missions, infiltrating and exfiltrating covert teams deep into North Vietnam, usually using the big HH-53 Super Jolly Green Giant or CH-53 helicopters.
And who were these teams?
Mostly American special operators, he said, but sometimes Laotians or Vietnamese personnel too. Often working with the CIA, Air America. Very clandestine stuff, deep behind enemy lines.
And then, incredibly, he found himself on the receiving end needing rescue. Twice.
Twice. The first time wasn't even in a fixed-wing plane. He was riding along in a Huey helicopter with the brigade commander when they got hit.
Just like that, you go from pilot to potential ground casualty.
Exactly. They auto-rotated down, landed hard, set up a defensive perimeter. Suddenly, he's a ground pounder waiting for rescue under fire. A stark reminder of the risks.
But the second time, 1972, flying an A-1 on a rescue mission, that one sounds particularly brutal. It involved a new threat.
A deadly new threat. The SA-7 Strela, a Soviet-made, shoulder-fired, heat-seeking missile. This was apparently the first time it was used effectively in that area, Kuanin, in Region 1.
And they learned about it the hard way.
The hardest way possible. He was trying to rescue a downed O-2 FAC pilot. There was even intel about a Russian technical team teaching the North Vietnamese how to use the SA-7s. The situation just escalated incredibly quickly. Several aircraft were shot down trying to get that O-2 pilot out.
And Harding went in anyway.
He and his wingman went in. His A-1 got hit squarely by an SA-7, blew the engine cowling off, damaged the propeller. He had no choice but to eject.
At only 1,200 feet, that's terrifyingly low for ejection.
Extremely low. And then, as if that wasn't enough, they started shooting at him while he was hanging in his parachute.
Unbelievable. How did he even survive on the ground?
His account is just incredible. He evaded capture initially. Then he actually engaged the enemy, used his service pistol, and then picked up an AK-47 from one of the enemy soldiers he took down.
He fought back on the ground.
He took out 3 enemy combatants in close quarters fighting. They even recovered the AK-47 he used later. It just shows the level of training and, well, sheer will to survive.
And how did he finally get rescued?
An army helicopter managed to get in. He literally jumped into it while it was hovering just off the ground. But the tragedy wasn't over.
His wingman, Don Screws, also got shot down.
Yes, despite Harding telling him to stay clear over the ocean and then trying to rescue Screws and the original Urchis pilot, more rescue helicopters were shot down by SA-7s.
It was a massacre.
It was catastrophic. 6 U.S. aircraft lost in that one rescue attempt. He compared it to the infamous Bat 21 rescue, which he was actually involved in coordinating later from NKP Nikon Phnom.
Did that disaster change how they did rescues?
It absolutely did. He said after that, the procedure changed significantly. They wouldn't send the rescue helicopters in until the FACs and strike aircraft had suppressed the ground fire and secured the area as much as possible. A brutal lesson learned through terrible loss.
And despite being shot down himself, rescued under fire, he kept flying these missions. The story about Oyster 01 Bravo, the AC-130 Spectre gunship down in Laos.
Another incredible one, rescuing the last 2 survivors, the pilot and co-pilot, after the others had bailed out. A CIA helicopter, an Air America Huey, was involved in that pickup.
And wasn't there a slightly unusual follow-up to that?
Ah, yes. He mentioned that 2 days later, after maybe a few too many celebratory drinks with the Air America crew who made the pickup, they somehow convinced him to take the controls of the Huey for a bit. A nerve-wracking experience, he said, having never really flown a helicopter before.
Wow. Speaks to the kind of environment they were in. Then there was the rescue of Clyde Smith, Bengal 505, an EB-66 electronic warfare plane. That took 5 days.
5 intense days. Smith was down right at a major junction of Ho Chi Minh trail routes. very strategic spot, meaning very heavily defended. Lots of anti-aircraft artillery, the AAA.
Had they managed that?
They actually used CS gas riot control gas dropped from the air to try and keep the enemy away from Smith. They had recordings from EC-47, signals intelligence aircraft, and the Vietnamese planning traps. Multiple FACs worked for days suppressing the AAA. Harding himself took heavy fire trying to support the effort. Dale Stovall was also involved as a wingman, a real team effort over a long, dangerous period.
And the Oyster rescue, Roger. Down for 20 days. That sounds impossible.
20 days evading capture. It was the northernmost rescue they'd done up to that point, near Yen Bai Airfield, north of Hanoi. Deep in enemy territory.
How did they even find him?
Ron Smith and his wingman located him. Then they had to plan a route in, trying to avoid known SAM sites and AAA concentrations, kind of like navigating the infamous Thud Ridge area. They still took fire over villages going in.
And the pickup itself.
Ron Smith and Buck Buchanan went in for the actual pickup, but it didn't end there. On the way out, they encountered and actually engaged an armored train.
An armored train.
Yes. And then they were intercepted by a North Vietnamese MiG fighter jet. They managed to evade it and land safely, even though Ron Smith had engine trouble. Just unbelievable series of events.
It really highlights that commitment you mentioned to leave no one behind, no matter the cost.
It's the driving force behind all these stories. The Air Force's commitment was absolute.
Let's talk about one more lineaman, Valiant 04 Alpha. Four F-4 Phantoms shot down, 8 crewmen on the ground.
A terrible situation. One airman was captured quickly. Rescuing Lynn Ammon was particularly challenging. The helicopter had to hover high because of the terrain. The rescue hoist, the penetrator, kept hitting trees. Then the hydraulics failed. They had to cut the cable.
A nightmare scenario.
It's a total nightmare. PJ Chuck McGrath was on the ground trying to help him on. Dale Stovall was the helicopter pilot who made the incredibly courageous decision to go back in for Amon, despite taking intense fire from all sides. His co-pilot was calling out incoming rounds constantly. Amon even got hit again by shrapnel during the extraction.
Just getting him out was a miracle.
It truly was. And Harding mentioned a powerful reunion years later at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Museum. Harding, Stovall the pilot, McGrath the PJ, and Amon the rescued pilot, all together in the actual helicopter that pulled him out. Imagine that moment.
That's incredible. Gives you chills. Looking back on all this, Colonel Harding also shared some deeper reflections, didn't he? About the war, the losses, the country.
He did. His involvement with the Vietnam Veterans of America clearly means a lot to him. That sense of brotherhood, the shared sacrifice. He also offered his perspective on, well, winning wars.
He felt the approach had changed since Korea.
Yes. Echoing a sentiment from another veteran, Daryl Whittem, that maybe they fought the Vietnam War in the wrong place, focusing too much on South Vietnam instead of Laos and North Vietnam directly. Harding's view was blunt. He felt the U.S. doesn't really win anymore, but tends to back out.
And he had concerns about the consequences of that.
Serious concerns about empowering adversaries, even potential threats within the U.S. itself. These are definitely views shaped by seeing the conflict and its aftermath up close.
He mentioned briefing President Johnson once, and the whole idea of graduated pressure that was prevalent then, he didn't think much of it.
He thought it was fundamentally flawed, especially against adversaries, as he put it, like Orientals or Muslims, who he believed had a different mindset playing a long game, totally committed, willing to endure hardship indefinitely. It's his perspective, offering a critique of that era's strategy.
He referenced General MacArthur's warning about land wars in Asia, too.
He did. And pointed to the enemy's willingness to accept massive casualties, citing examples from Vietnam and even more recent events. He drew a very sharp distinction in his mind between what he saw as murder by adversaries and the necessary killing of the enemy in combat. Again, strong views forged in wartime.
And his final thoughts were quite personal, touching on faith and his concerns about the country's direction today.
Very much so. He spoke about the importance of faith in God, the idea of being created in God's image, and his worries that society is prioritizing personal desires over, you know, fundamental right and wrong. He linked this to what he called the influence of Satan.
He also expressed concerns about the military today.
Yeah, he questioned whether the same level of dedication and core values he witnessed still exists. It's a sobering reflection from someone with his background, hoping for a return to what he sees as foundational principles. It's important to present these as his deeply held beliefs, stemming from his life experiences.
Absolutely. So wrapping this up, Colonel Harding's accounts just paint this incredibly vivid picture. The sheer danger faced by everyone flying in Vietnam, the vital, often unsung role of the forward air controllers, which, as we noted, connects back to our deep dive in episode 70, and just the unbelievable courage involved in combat search and rescue.
And the personal cost. He himself shot down twice, facing intense enemy fire time and time again.
For me, one detail that really stands out is that reunion he described at the museum. Harding, Stovall, McGrath, Amon, all there with the helicopter that saved Amon's life after that horrific ordeal. That really brings home the human connection and the legacy of these events.
It does. And that close quarters fight he had on the ground after ejecting, using a captured AK-47, it's just raw survival against the odds.
So for you listening, we hope this deep dive into Colonel Harding's firsthand testimony gives you a perspective that goes way beyond the usual history books. It's personal, it's intense, and it really complements the strategic discussions we've had before, like in episode 70.
And maybe it leaves you with a final thought to consider. What is the true personal toll of experiencing combat at that intensity, day after day? How do those experiences shape individuals, and maybe even the nation, long after the fighting stops?
Definitely something to reflect on. The dedication, the sacrifice, the commitment to saving a single life against overwhelming odds. How does that resonate today?
Food for thought. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Thank you.